Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we actually have a new co-host. And as a matter of fact, let me kind of explain and introduce to you Angeline. And as a matter of fact, Angeline, I don't know what last name you go by.
Well, I go by Angeline Marie.
Okay. Angeline Marie, that's folks. This name. Is Angeline Marie. And you broadcast, I know you broadcast out of the Kansas City area.
Yes, I broadcast on KCXL out of Kansas City, also on the K-Star Talk Radio Network and Liberty Works Radio Network. And then I have a website where I have my archives, and I have a Rumble channel, and they all you can catch everything from TruthSeekersRadioShow.com.
There you go. So you are the truth seeker.
I'm one of a million truth seekers right now.
No, but
you know, it's funny when I went to find a show name. I didn't want it to be, you know, like everybody else's show, the you know, Jane Doe show or whatever. And I prayed about it, and Truth Seekers came to me, and so that's where I get Truth Seekers Radio Show.
Well, there you go. I consider myself a truth seeker. I didn't, you know, choose the name. So anyway, but and is this the only Truth Seekers Radio Show, or are there actually other ones that are not affiliated?
You know, when I was looking for my domain name, I did find that there are a couple other shows. One of them looked kind of new agey. Okay. There weren't really, I mean, there has to probably be some that are in this alternative news/whatever space, but what I found was new age, and this would have been, goodness, about 20, I think I started in 2012 or 13, somewhere around there.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, like Art Bell, new agey, you know, the UFOs.
Yeah. Yes.
Really out there type of stuff. Okay, so without too much of a further delay, and as a matter of fact, what I'll do is I'll provide some details on our important information page so that people will have a link to your all of your contacts that you want to share with me. And same thing with the bio. I'm all about content, and I'm really kind of informal, so it's no disrespect whatsoever other than the fact that I want people to understand that you're broadcasting in the heartland of America, and right now there is, I don't want to call it a bloody battle, but there is a battle going on for the heart and souls of patriots of America. And everybody sees what's going on, and nobody can ignore the smell, that rotten smell from Denmark. And so people are being compelled one way or the other, and I think it's more of a spiritual compelling to get involved somehow. And so there's people that are joining the Convention of State efforts to try to drive that. There are people that are, you know, wanting to be the conservative status quo. No, we need to do this the old-fashioned way, vote our people in, that type of stuff. We've got another group that is really big in your area. And folks, this is really one of the reasons why I was really happy to hook up with you. And that's just due to the fact that you broadcast in an area where the growth of the sovereign citizen movement, the General Assembly movement, these people that are being convinced that the Constitution is the problem. And they're being given misinformation regarding the 14th Amendment. They're giving them misinformation regarding our history and so forth, and convincing people to actually side against the Constitution.
And I interviewed a couple people like this. Now, to be honest, when you and I last spoke, you told me about your feeling on the Constitution, and I completely agree with you, and then you gave me even more insight about, you know, God being the inspiration and And I believe that, and I believe that that was the true foundation. But man, as we know, man always perverts and ruins and changes. And so I would have to side with those guys that, you know, in the sovereign citizen movement. Actually, when I interviewed a guy and I said the sovereign citizen movement, he did not like that term. But what I'm getting at is I do understand, and in some instances, at this point at least, I'm open to learning more. I mean, that's what this whole thing is about, right? I don't just
make up
my mind and that's it.
No. So
I'm always seeking the truth. That's why I'm a truth seeker.
Okay, good.
But I do see their point because of the perversion, and let's be honest, who's running the show right now in this ugly world? And so they always seep in. Evil always seems to seep in and pervert what God got, what the godly intention was originally. He always wants to change and modify and put his ugliness in there. So I have to say that when they bring up certain points, and I'll address just a couple now, and then
go ahead.
Go from there, so you kind of know where I stand.
Sure.
I interviewed Adele Weiss, and all he does is he helps people get out of what he calls the tax club. Mm-hmm. And so he helps people go through the process so that they don't have to pay income tax. And everybody just is under this assumption that we're supposed to pay that. And I don't believe that's true after speaking with him. Yes, if you make some sort of profit, yes, you do, and you do pay those taxes, but on wages you're trading your time for the money and your energy for the money. And so in that instance, what I feel like what he's doing is good, and I'm pretty sure the way I understand, they are not supposed to put that tax on our back, and yet they do it. And so that's just an example. And then another guy I recently stumbled on, his first name is Tlaib. I forget what his last name was, but he has been fighting courts, and he knows how to do that and weave his way through the courts because he says they don't have jurisdiction. So you see, there's all these different little examples I can give. But my underlying question is, if we're still under the Constitution the way God intended, why is it that when Adele helps people by filling out and submitting certain forms and getting them out of what he calls the tax club, if it wasn't an issue, it wouldn't be an issue. In other words, there'd be no use for Adele's services. There would be no use for Tlaib to go and try to wiggle his way out of being unfairly convicted for a crime he didn't do just because they're playing what he calls word salad and word games in the court system. So that's where I come from. If it's not a thing, why are these people fighting for their right not to have to pay a tax on their wage? And why is Tlaib having to go out there, you know, while he was jailed and he got out, because they had nothing to stand on. But you see, they make you think they have something to stand on with all of the gibberish that they use. So that's kind of when I say I understand where these people are coming from with the deception. That is like the perfect word, deception. With all the deception that the devil does with everything he tries to ruin in God's creation, mm-hmm. That's when I say I see where they're coming from. That's what I mean, G.R.
Yeah, so,
I know that was a long-winded answer.
No. It's absolutely, and so it's okay. So the truth that you're seeking and what you're hearing, because there's truth in what they're saying, and what I mean by that is that the federal court does not have legitimate jurisdiction over things that do not arise under that Constitution. And they've assumed jurisdiction well beyond. And they've been assuming jurisdiction since the 1800s, early 1800s. and they really started going, I'll just say, exponentially increasing their jurisdiction. As soon as Madison and the frame, most all of the framers had passed away, got out of government, and that's when they started injecting unconstitutional legal processes like case law, precedents. Those things are, there's no allowance for those within the Constitution. I could go on and on and on, but when it comes down to taxation, the federal government does have the authority to tax. And what Adele, if that's the correct, if that person is actually teaching people that they can get out from underneath the tax code, he's absolutely correct as well. And when he stands up and says, you don't really have jurisdiction under the Constitution, he's absolutely correct as well. The problem is not the Constitution. Now, there are groups, and you haven't said anything regarding groups that are misleading people to say that the 14th Amendment is the problem. There are.
Yeah, and I heard you this morning in the wee hours. I was listening to your program, and you were addressing that, and I completely agree with that. And that was a really good way to put it, that they are saying that the Constitution is the problem. I agree with you 100% on that.
And so we need every back, every shoulder, every fist in this fight. And when people abjure themselves from the United States, they no longer have the right to vote. They no longer have a dog in the fight. It's like the parent that divorces themselves and leaves the family, regardless of whether they're male or female, mom or dad, it doesn't matter. When you've left the family, you've lost the ability to say, you know, how you want your child to be raised, or what's going on in the family. And so this is why Madison, it was very adamant against nullification, which is a different concept we haven't even talked about. But nullification is where you prove that the law is illegitimate and you say, we're not enforcing this. And now nullification as a collective group is the parties to the compact. The states have the authority to nullify, but a single state, which was the Southern states' perversion of this doctrine, which is why Madison wrote his notes on nullification in 1834, when this concept that a single state could nullify and stay in the union is basically like being in a marriage and saying, I'm not going to abide by these, you know, these laws of marriage. I'm going to do what I want to do because this doesn't fit my lifestyle or how I want to live in this marriage. And so you can actually see how chaos that would be if, you know, one person in the marriage, and in this particular marriage or union of the states, we got 50. We have 50 states. And as 50 states all decide to say, well, we're going to go back to doing this, or we're going to stop doing this, and it creates chaos. The reality, and I think what the Lord has basically given us the ability to do, is to unify as the states and say, look, we're not the problems here. The federal government does not have the authority to do any of these things, and we need to assert our power. The reason why the federal government was successful in passing all of these different things, in getting the states to go along in the 1800s when they wanted to usurp the management of health care for children and created the Children's Bureau. The reason that the states went along is because the federal government came with money and gave it to them and said, we're going to do this, and this is good for the children, and the states took it. And so the reality, as Madison breaks it down in his veto against the Department of Transportation, it doesn't matter if the states allow it to be done unconstitutionally. It is still unconstitutional. And at any point in time, the states can disassemble it just like that. All they have to do is enforce their compact. And so that's the process of republic review. But as we go down this, I'll just call it the discovery of the truth, I think things will start laying in place to help people start to understand that the Constitution is a covenant. It was a covenant of 50 states that all came in and said they were going to abide and empower this little body called the federal government. And it was the responsibility of the parties in that covenant, the states, to ensure that that creature that federal government that they created stayed within the confines of the Constitution. And who would have thought, you know, only the Lord knew, that they would very quickly get out from underneath that by using money. And look at, they've been doing this for so long. We're at 30 some trillion dollars in debt, and it's all unconstitutional. It's all fraud. We don't even owe that money. But the bottom line is when we look at how far we've gone, and they still haven't collapsed us yet. That's how resilient this Constitution and this union really is. I mean, we've taken a lot of blows, and we're hanging by a thread. I think that we're on our last leg, because it's just a matter of our next their next expedient meltdown. They're going to create a meltdown that is going to justify putting aside the Constitution. And why I'm really worried about these people that are selling these concepts that the Constitution is illegitimate, it's our problem. They're actually getting people to say, well, you know, who cares? We don't need it anyway. We can't have that. We actually, I think, as citizens, just like as a citizen of heaven, we have a responsibility to defend our citizenship and to defend heaven or this Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. So... Anyway, I will move forward with you. What we want to do is we really need to challenge the legitimacy of the 14th Amendment. And so I sent you a spreadsheet. And so are you able to, because folks, this is all available. If you go to the 14th Amendment on Wikipedia, all of this information is there. You just have to kind of sort through it. And so I sent you that spreadsheet. And if you open it up, we've got the Civil War states. And there are a total of 25 states in the Union during the Civil War. And there are a total of 11 states that were a part of the Confederacy. And so the 14th Amendment, the drive behind the 14th Amendment was the failing of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. The radical Republicans wanted to do everything they could to protect and to, you know, to ensure humanity was being protected, because in this particular case, it was the freedmen. But down the road, the Indians, there's other different groups of people that could have easily been discriminated and oppressed. And so the 14th Amendment really made it so that there would be no more oppression by the states, because the states were the bad actors here. They killed people. They were doing things that went that far to where they were killing freedmen. And I'm not sure if you knew this, but if you do the research, and actually I sent you an article that was done by Kurt Lash, that in, I think it was June or July of 1866, there were almost 200 freedmen that went to a political convention in New Orleans, and the local police and other KKK and other people, law enforcement and what have you, went into that convention and killed all these people. And that became such a, and this is one of the things that kills me, this is not being taught, but that became one of the real catalysts, because the 14th Amendment was already out. It went out, I think, early June, and it was out for ratification. Excuse me. And on the heels of this massacre, a lot of people go, you can't tell me that they're not killing people. And so it really became, it was almost like a battle cry of the abolitionists up in the northern states to say, you know, we have to stop this. They're just going to keep killing without impunity. And and so bottom line, the 14th Amendment was actually ratified, and if you actually click on the tab on the 14th Amendment, it was literally ratified within 1 year. Because if you notice, I have the green, I actually count out the states and the date it was ratified. And the final date it was ratified was June 15th. That's when the 19 states, because if you do the math, folks, you only need 18 and a half states out of 25 to get your 3/4 threshold. And so June 15th, 1867, the 14th Amendment was legitimately ratified by all of the states in the Union. I'm not counting any of the Confederacy states. But bottom line, or actually, you know what? By accident, I do have that. So we have 18, and it was legitimately ratified in March 16th. Now, the three states later on, so we actually reached the threshold at March 16th, but three states attempted to actually go beyond that. And what I mean by that is three states, New Jersey, Oregon, and Ohio, after they ratified it in 1868, they decided that they wanted to rescind that ratification. Now, there's no language. And as a matter of fact, once you've done that, and once they got to that threshold, or once they were there, once that that ratification was accepted by Congress, you can't, there's no vehicle or mechanism to allow that to be done. The only way you can actually legitimately have that done is you have to get Congress to say, okay, we'll allow you to change your position. That's only happened once in the history of this republic. There's only one, determination on an amendment by a state. In other words, in 2010, Delaware rejected, or in 1913, Delaware rejected the 17th Amendment. And in 2010, Delaware turned around and said, we want to rescind our rejection and ratify it. And at that point, that was the first time the federal government, to my knowledge, ever allowed a state to change its position. And the reason why is because if they allow you to change your position on an amendment, then, because it's one thing for a state to do it for credentials, you know, okay, we don't want to look like the bad racist state or what have you, so they change it on their own. But for the federal government to actually change that and allow that change to be counted, then they open the door for other states to be able to change their position. Does that make sense? Because the door has to swing both ways. Mm-hmm. And so once the thing is ratified, it's done. It doesn't really matter. Everything else is just frosting, or it's just, I will say, you know, garnishment for the state to, you know, make good and seem like they're not so racist. Because if you notice, if you go through the long list on the left hand, on the right hand side, you'll notice that Kentucky in 1976, finally ratified, even though they rejected it. In 1976, they finally ratified the 14th Amendment. But that was not a formal ratification. They'd already rejected it. They just did that as a garnishment to say, yeah, we as a government are now, you know, in support of. But it wasn't a formal acceptance and change. Mm-hmm. So what really happened is the question was, did the southern states actually step out of the Union? Did they secede? And on this show, we've gone through the secession notes, so we don't have to go through this. But if you go to the Avalon Project, you'll actually find in the 19th century documents for the southern states and their secession letters, you know, basically going to Congress and saying, we're seceding from the Union and we're leaving. And right in the very first paragraph, usually they mention that they're leaving because of slavery. Now, that's only four of them. But bottom line, what ended up happening was 11 states pulled back their representation and their senators. So all representation left Congress. So what does that mean? Does that mean that they're still in the Union? No, that meant that they actually did secede. They left the Union and they formed their own government. They formed a confederacy. So because they crossed that line and basically seceded from the Union and not being a part of the Union, getting back to the ratification, they could not ratify. They couldn't be involved in the ratification process, nor could they join the Union until the 14th Amendment was ratified, which is why that Tennessee is up there. Tennessee wanted to join the Union quickly, and the admission criteria for a state to join the Union prior to the 14th ratification is that they had to ratify it. And that was actually, you know, out there. Now, when we read Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, are you there? Do you have that?
Yes.
Okay. So Article 3 of Section 4 states, or Section 3 of Article 4 states this: new states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union. So if a state leaves the Union, Can a state just come back in on their own and say, we're back in?
It doesn't appear that
way. No, it doesn't. They actually, Congress has the control. If you want to come back in, you have to come back in on the criteria that they're going to establish. And so Congress established that criteria. Congress right here had the constitutional power to do that. So it really boils down to, did the states actually secede? All the evidence and empirical data proves that they did. So for them to come back in, does Congress have the authority to say, you can't just come back in? Absolutely they do. And they have the authority to set that criteria. And so I'm just trying to paint this picture. Is the 14th Amendment legitimate? Absolutely it is. There was just so much contention over the 14th Amendment that, and I think I sent you another document, that it was in question going into the 1870s. There were books that were being written where, you know, there were so many states that were clamoring that, oh, well, we rejected that. And nobody actually went to Congress to say, is that legitimate? Did they really reject that? They just took these, I think it was Oregon, Ohio, and New Jersey that were the three states that rejected their ratification of it. They said, is that legitimate? And, you know, no, they didn't do that. Or no, they didn't legitimately reject. They just on their own said, oh, we didn't mean that. And so, but they couldn't undo it. And anyway, so there was all of these questions, and unfortunately, or fortunately, and actually I think it was fortunately for those who had the dark hand in this game. And I say that because we didn't have communications that, you know, you couldn't fly in a couple of hours to get from coast to coast. We didn't have, you know, electronic video and YouTube and all the technology that we have today. In other words, things were so closed and so confined of evidence and having to be physical evidence and so forth that it could be easily buried. And I say this because as we get into this, Paul and I have covered the 13th Amendment, the original 13th Amendment, and how after the 14th Amendment, it disappears. And so the 14th Amendment became one of those so contentious that they couldn't just get rid of it like the 13th Amendment. So what they had to do was they had to create this mystique that the 14th Amendment is just a really bad amendment, and they started reinterpreting it. And one of the first reinterpretations of the 14th Amendment was during Plessy v. Ferguson over a railroad case where blacks were being segregated into a crappy, you know, train car where they couldn't sit with the whites. And that was ruled that separate but equal. As long as they have equal accommodations and they're separate, that's fine. So this is where racism or those types of things actually started playing against, and they used the 14th Amendment in redefining it to say, yes, this equal protection, but is, you know, it doesn't mean that you have absolute equal protection, because separate but equal becomes the new interpretation of equal protection. Then later on down the road, we started seeing the progressive courts, like the Warren Court, trying to undo that. And in the Warren Court, that's where they actually converted the United States into a democracy unconstitutionally by redefining the 14th Amendment and equal protection under the law. So the court, who has no authority to redefine the Constitution or what these lines mean, but they've been doing it. And this goes back to these gentlemen that you've talked to and these people that you're aware of, where they talk about the Constitution being the problem. No, the problem is all of these evil players that have been redefining it and twisting it. And as I kind of talk about and point out, that when you look at the Constitution being like a rigid piece of wood, if you soak it in the swamp of our legal system, these people will start bending it and twisting it, and they will redefine it into something completely different than the solid wood that it is. And so this is how they've gotten the latitude of being able to create all of these unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, powers that have been inflicted upon us. Actually, this goes all the way back to 1820 when they inflicted slavery upon the states. So, because clearly, when you're looking at Article 4, Section 3, there is no allowance there that they can create the ability to lessen the state coming into the union. In other words, they can't lessen their sovereignty. They have to come in equal-footed. In other words, the state has full sovereignty to determine whether they're going to be slave or not, you know, how they want to do their own economics, as long as they're using the dollar, the currency, and those types of things. States have full autonomy from the federal government is how they're going to operate. And when they created the Missouri Compromise and inflicted slavery, that was a direct violation of Article 4, Section 3. So anyway, I know we've got a lot to cover, but what I wanted to do is give you this. Is there anything that you have questions on regarding the legitimacy of the 14th Amendment?
No, but I may have questions as we go through today.
Okay, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm counting on that. So if you want to participate in the reading, we can actually go through Section 1, and there's three parts of this. As a matter of fact, when you look at the color-coded Constitution that I gave you, the middle section is yellow, correct?
Now we're under Article 4, Section 1?
No. We're now on the 14th Amendment, because now we're going to get into what the 14th Amendment actually says. And so if you look at Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, then you'll see that the middle section says no state shall make or enforce any law. That's all yellow. And then it goes to nor shall any state deprive any person. The 14th Amendment, that's actually on page 18 of the document, the color-coded Constitution.
I don't even have page numbers on this.
It would be at the bottom. Oh, yeah, it's at the bottom of the frame for the Windows. But, yeah, if you use the navigation screen, it would be Article XIV.
Yeah, I have it all printed out.
Oh, you printed it out. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's okay then. So what I was going to tell you is that the second part, there's three parts of Section 1. There's the citizen part, then there's the privileges and immunities clause, and then there is, in the third part, there's two subsections. There is due process and then the equal protection. So actually there's four parts. So, but those last two parts, nor shall any state, so let me read this and then I'll point out what I'm changing to yellow, because I've revealed in some of the research that I've done how these parts of the 14th Amendment are egregiously being violated because of the redefining of the 14th Amendment by the courts. So Section 1 states all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. This right here basically converted every person of, I'll call it person of color, or technically the two categories in America were the Indians and the slaves, or the blacks in America, became citizens. And the reason why is because that second part of this, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Because are not Indians who are living on Indian reservations or in American territories, are they not under the jurisdiction of the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so it's the same thing with slaves who were already under the jurisdiction because they actually had apportionment based on, you know, the population of slaves. So they were given some form of representation. Therefore, slaves and Indians were under the jurisdiction. So as long as they were born here or naturalized in the United States. So naturalized means that they were brought here and became a, under the old system, became a piece of property. So in this particular case, if a slave was bought in 1855 and brought in as and became a piece of property for a plantation owner, then that plantation owner, you know, would have had naturalized them in that, making them property. It would have been the same process of that. And so because that plantation owner, based on that property, was getting apportionment for representation because he had that many people, or slaves, I should say. And so the naturalization process for slaves was actually in play because they were still bringing them in and or, you know, being moved in, even though the states no longer had the authority to import slaves after 1808, there was still that possibility. So bottom line, what they decided was they were going to ensure that whether they were naturalized or whether they were born in the United States, they would still become a citizen of the United States. They didn't have to just necessarily be born in the United States. And so all Indians, it's the same thing. All Indians that were living within the territory, born there and so forth, or naturalized, they became citizens. And there was actually dialogue in the 14th Amendment saying you do realize that this is pointing to Indians becoming citizens as well. All colored people at that point is what they were calling it. And yeah. And as a matter of fact, this stanza, so the 14th Amendment was initially started in March of 1866. This one line, because it came up as they were getting close to ratification, that there was still this problem of the right of citizen because of the Dred Scott case. The Dred Scott case, basically, as it won in Missouri, in other words, Dred Scott was freed by a jury of his peers of 12 white men, allowed to go free. And so that case got appealed, and I think it was the state attorney general that appealed it and took it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And Taney made the ruling that because he was not a citizen, he couldn't vote, nor could he be free, and basically sent Dred Scott back into slavery by the ruling of the Supreme Court. And so they wanted to make sure that they didn't play that game. So they actually constitutionally made them citizens and added that stanza, I want to say late, either May 20th, somewhere around there, May 20th, 27th, something like that. So the next part, this part right here, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. That part was the beginning and the genesis of this first stanza. This was done by John Bingham out of Ohio. He was a representative and a part of the Radical Republicans, and he was on record for stating that this was to apply to all of the rights, privileges, immunities that were protected by the U.S. Constitution. Kurt Lash, I think I sent you the three-part series of that. Kurt Lash goes through a really good academic study, and he kind of points out John Bingham's assertion and so forth, and really clarifies the fact that this is protecting citizens from states being able to deny their ability to openly and freely, you know, worship, to be speech, to petition government, the right to bear arms, to be secure in their persons from seizure and searches. All of these protections under the Bill of Rights and under the Constitution were to be afforded all citizens, regardless of race. And so the third part, which is that nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law, I point out to people that that's actually a duplication of, I think, either the fourth. That's already in the Bill of Rights, and I don't know why they duplicated the right of due process, because it was being applied in the line above. And then the final part, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, having gone through the 14th Amendment and the debates on this, the intent behind this equal protection of the laws was not to allow segregation, was to ensure that if a privilege, immunity, and or a protection of the law was being provided to one person, it is to be provided to all. So in other words, if a person shows up and they're going to sit in this booth at a restaurant or at the bar at a restaurant, then that was open to all citizens. If it was open to a customer, it was open to all customers. And so they really started going after this very quickly with Jim Crow laws by segregating and forcing slaves, or I should say freedmen, to actually no longer be able to sit at the bar, or they put them in a booth in the corners or whatever. The segregation laws started coming out, and that was Jim Crow laws. And Jim Crow laws basically said, you don't have a right to sit anywhere you want. You have to sit over here because we've created a second class of quality of space and accommodations for you. And that was, it was literally an insult. But bottom line, all of those Jim Crow laws were direct violations of the equal protection of the laws. So now that
we... this is, I can't tell you exactly, but this is the piece where those, the sovereign citizen start to say that, I believe that's what they say.
Yeah, so one of the things that they say, you're right, and I know that they don't like that. It's either nationalists or what. The term sovereign citizen is just kind of like, I use that as a lump of the jural, right, because the jural assemblies do not like to be called, you know, a sovereign, or, you know, to be lumped in those people that are going to protect themselves from taxes. The jural assemblies, you know, kind of straddle the line a little closer. But anyway, one of the things that they point out is that this first line of the citizen is where they believe that this is making everybody chattel. There's absolutely, there's absolutely no confirmation that that's how it was defined. Now, there was a, I will call them a, what do you want to call it? An opponent to the 14th Amendment during the discourses and the debates of the 14th Amendment. So I tell people this, that when you're really looking at a contract and you're looking at a stanza in the contract and you have people that are proponents, in other words, selling the compact, and this is what it means, and then people that are trying to cancel it, trying to shut it down and say, no, no, and they come out with these really hyperbole. So there was an assertion by an opponent to the 14th Amendment that that's what happened. But if you take what that person said, that was rejected because that person was trying to get the 14th Amendment rejected. And overwhelmingly, the 14th Amendment passed both houses. In other words, they rejected his assertion. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's the same thing as the ratification debates. When the anti-federalists made assertions, so, I mean, George Mason literally stated that the evil District of Columbia, because Congress and the federal government had full control of it, the darkest of evil and a cauldron of evil spirits would be stirred up. And, you know, so that was just hyperbole. There is no legitimacy. You have to look at how it was defined by those who were really stipulating and providing the clarity or the definitions of what these lines meant. And those who were challenging that, you know, they get away with a lot. And as a matter of fact, Kurt Lash points out that you'll find that the majority of the chatter out of the 263, now, I sent you the link to it, and if you want to download it, by all means, take a look at it. There are 263 pages that I've extracted from the Congressional Globe. Out of those, there's three columns of each page. One column is equivalent to one page in Word. So what that means is if you take 263 times three, you're pretty close to about 1,000 pages of documentation to go through. And the majority of that, as Kurt Lash points out, there was so much opposition by very specific key players that were up there saying, oh, this is going to do this and this is going to do that. One would think that the amendment itself had such great contention that it wasn't going to pass. And yet it passed overwhelmingly. So It's, you know, it's just like when we see today with C-SPAN, when one side, you know, is trying to pass a bill and it's the last ditch effort of the other side to say anything and everything and go on the record for, you know, making all sorts of outlandish assertions, and they go into the record, but that doesn't make it legitimate. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And so I also sent you the 1967 congressional record where a few Democrats, there were literally, I think, three or four Democrats in play that actually got up and kind of tag-teamed like WWF, making all of this, I'll just say, wild assertions that they have no evidence. They basically were saying that the 14th Amendment was illegitimate, it never was ratified, you know, it had been rejected, and blah, blah, blah. They were doing everything they can in 1967 to basically get rid of the 14th Amendment. And it's kind of interesting because back and forth, you know, the progressives have been huge advocates for parts of the 14th Amendment, but, you know, they're equally saying, oh, we got to get rid of it, because the real part of the 14th Amendment that the progressives hate, and they're just now starting to use it in its improper context, is Section 3, by trying to go after Trump and saying, hey, Trump violated Section 3 at least, and so we need to go after him with that, but it actually doesn't apply to the president. I mean, these people are so illiterate, they grab at things and they just start spinning it, and they get everybody to believe what they're saying, and anyway, so you're right. Section 1 was tried to be misrepresented, but there's no evidence of that. And I'd love to see anybody show me, you know, exactly who, as a proponent for the 14th Amendment, did say that this was to be used to do this. Not at all. And what ended up happening, and the whole creation of, I'll just say, the thought of subjugation, all came out of the 1871 Organic Act. And I'll actually get into the Organic Act once we're done with all of the amendments to the Constitution. Paul and I will get into that. And you're more than welcome if you want to tag along, or just you can at least pull it in and listen as we read through the Organic Act and what that does. Because mm-hmm. that empowers Congress to start creating corporations. And basically that is how they start moving all of us into that direction of control. And it's interesting. It's really interesting. The guy that the people that were actually out trying to stop the 14th Amendment voted for this subjugation. Isn't that interesting? In other words,
yeah. I vaguely remember the video that I did and I shared with you. I think it was called Season of. I can't remember the name of the video, but that's the guy, and I believe he was talking about that act that you just were talking about.
Yes, uh-huh.
I think he said that was the start of this whole thing.
Yep.
Where they started to control us.
Oh, yeah. And well, so that was one of those things, the control taken by the courts. By the time we got to the Civil War, there were so many different violations of the Constitution. I mean, Lincoln suspended our constitutional rights. I mean, Lincoln was a tyrant. I mean, he was terrible.
They paint him like he was a saint.
Oh, so,
today.
Yeah, and I think that that's just because, you know, most people think he was really anti-slavery when he really wasn't. I mean, I actually cited the Douglas debates of what Lincoln really thought of blacks. I mean, Thomas Jefferson had a high opinion of blacks. As, you know, he started meeting more and more academic blacks in America, he was absolutely, you know, it literally shifted his paradigm. It was a catalyst for a paradigm shift for him. But anyway, let me move on. We've got about 5 minutes for this show, and we've still got these five sections to go through. So the next section, if you're there on the 14th Amendment.
I'm there because I ended up pulling it up on the screen.
Okay, good. So Section 2, the representatives, and this is apportionment. And this really helps speak to who has the legitimate right to vote and apportionment for representation. So go ahead and dive into this.
Okay, so section two, representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed. But when the right to vote at any election for the choice of electors for president and vice president of the United States, representatives in Congress, the executive and judicial officers of a state, or the members of the legislature thereof, is denied to any of the male inhabitants of such state being 21 years of age and citizens of the United States, or in any way abridged except for participation in rebellion or other crime, the basis of representation therein shall be reduced in the proportion which the number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens 21 years of age in such state.
Excellent job. Excellent job. So what this really is saying is that if any state wants to take any of these folks, because the only Indians that are not included are the ones that are not taxed. In other words, they are, you know, still maintaining some autonomy. I do not, because they actually did have and still did have Indians in the other states. So even though Andrew Jackson had the Trail of Tears, it didn't mean that there were other Indians that maintained autonomy. The reason that the Trail of Tears existed is because the Cherokee actually integrated, and they created the first newspaper in the South. They actually had the first printed newspaper. They actually started learning commerce, and they were beating the poor white folks in the South at their own game. And they were being so successful that they pleaded to have these people removed. And that's why Jackson removed them.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, and had he actually protected them and actually did what he was supposed to do and basically say, sorry, you know, these people have just as much right, to be there as you do. But instead he allowed, this is at the same time, I mean, around the same time, they started going after, I think it was the Mormons around this time, in the 30s or the 40s or what have you. And so, you know, we actually started playing games as a nation in saying we're going to favor one group over another. And the federal government was never created to create favors. They were there to make sure that everybody had an equal opportunity. So back to that intent that you talked about, this divine intent of equal opportunity. So anyway, as we look at the states who were seeking, I got about a minute and a half to see if I can get this through. As we looked at the states that were trying to play these games, they were already doing this stuff in the South. So they said, okay, if you're going to take away the right to vote of any male inhabitant, and you know, if that's the case, then you will have that number, those numbers deducted from your apportionment. And in this, the most important thing is this identifies that a person has to be a U.S. citizen to be apportioned and to vote. And so what ended up happening, the reason why this is important is in 1980, Jimmy Carter decided to start counting illegal aliens, or I should say invaders that happened to be in America, or anybody that was in America that wasn't a U.S. citizen, to be counted and apportioned to that state. And it created a whole realignment of Congress to shift towards California and places that had a high population of non-citizens. And Trump actually tried to address that in 2020, and the courts and everybody saying, no, they have to have apportionment. And I'm screaming at the top of my lungs, are you kidding me? Read this right here. And if you go through the other parts of the Constitution where it talks about voting and everything else, there are four more amendments. We've got the right to vote for all races, the women's right to vote, the removal of the poll tax for that right to vote, and the age of 18 right to vote in America. Each of them require that you must be a U.S. citizen. So with that, We're going to end up on that, and we'll have you back. Folks, we'll be back with Angeline for our next episode to wrap up. Hopefully, we'll wrap up the 14th Amendment. I'll try to keep it to the point in our next episode. Thank you so much. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.